From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel says President Trump raised nearly $25 million in less than 24 hours for his reelection bid after he formally kicked things off in Florida last night.
Our radical Democrat opponents are driven by hatred, prejudice, and rage. They want to destroy you, and they want to destroy our country as we know it. Not acceptable. It's not going to happen.
Well, meanwhile, at an event this morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Congress must impeach President Trump if the goods are there. Let's bring in our political strategist, Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. Hi, Maria.
Hey, how are you? Good to be with you guys.
Doing well. And Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hey.
Okay, so let's start with this Trump rally. There were 20,000 people in the Amway Center in Orlando last night. Apparently, the campaign rented buses to bring people in from around the state of Florida. Matt, did it move the needle at all?
Well, I think the fundraising hall is significant. I think sometimes people miss the point of the rallies. Certainly, the president likes doing them. He gets great energy from the audience. He likes to test different messages. But really, these rallies are about collecting data. They had well over 100,000 people sign up for this event, and they're providing their cell phone number and their email address. I do think the other advantage is they moved beyond some of the headlines last week about polling, internal polling and things like that, and made clear he's running for another term. They're running on a promises made, promises kept message on Keep America Great. So, look, was it a huge success? I don't know if I quite say that, but I do think it helped turn the page from last week and makes clear that that his base needs to help him if they want to see him stay in office and get reelected.
Well, Maria, what do you make of the fact that he didn't mention a lot of the candidates who are trying to run against him? He did talk a little bit about Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, but really he talked about Hillary Clinton.
Well, that says to me is that they actually do not want to turn the page. Trump is it's impossible for him to turn the page, meaning that he is still living in the past. He is obsessed with Hillary Clinton. I know that it really makes him mad whenever anybody points out that she actually got almost 3 million more votes than he did. He can't stand that. He has her on his mind constantly. And frankly, the whole rally was about the past. He is doubling down on the strategy that frankly did help him get elected in 2016. And that is a strategy based on division, based on hatred, based on prejudice, based on rage. It's really interesting that he accused the Democrats of that because that's exactly what he professes and what he traffics in. And he is doubling down on it, whether it's in his rallies or in his policies. When he announced on Twitter that he was going to start deporting the 1 million undocumented immigrants that are in the country.
But this worked in 2016. And Matt, I'm really curious as to why you were sort of half-hearted, I think, in your reaction to last night, if I've got that right, that, it wasn't as good as it could have been. I'd love to hear more from you as a Republican strategist. I mean, we know that, he was greeted by the Orlando Sentinel with a Enough of the Chaos headline, sort of a takedown of President Trump. As he's, coming to Florida, as it's been characterized, saying this is a guy we're not endorsing. He was looking forward in that he promised a cure for cancer and AIDS if reelected and a Mars landing. But that only maybe reminded people that he'd promised a border wall paid for by Mexico and an infrastructure and healthcare plan, and that hasn't happened. But if you looked at the pictures, you saw people really happy. Why did you not think this was such a big plus for him?
No, I thought it was fine. I guess to me it looked like a fairly standard rally.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of news there. I guess he rolled out the new kind of campaign slogan of Keep America Great, changing from Make America Great Again from 4 years ago. I just think this was an opportunity probably to make some news, to make some type of announcement, to try a different message. I wrote in my Washington Times column last week about the things I think he needs to do to put himself in a stronger position. Keep the economy strong, put the trade war stuff behind him, ignore the Democrats who are running in the primary. By attacking Joe Biden, all it does is unify Democrats around him. It makes them feel that Trump fears him. It makes them think, well, if Trump thinks Biden's bad, then Biden must be good. I think the greatest thing he has to do is he has to grow his base. The Real Clear Politics average national polls puts his job approval around 42 or 43%. On the economy, he's around 50%. He's in a range where this could go either direction, and mm-hmm. he's got a huge head start. They're doing significant work on the digital side, on the data side. They've raised over $100 million to this point. They have the biggest head start of any incumbent president probably in history. The question is, what are they going to do over the next year to maximize those advantages?
Okay, well, before we move on to some other issues, let's actually talk about some of the people who are trying to run against him right now. And the first debate on the Democratic side is coming up next week. There's going to be two nights with, I think, 10 candidates each night. We now know who's going to be in each debate. And on one night, Biden, Sanders, and Buttigieg will be on the stage. And on the other night, Beto O'Rourke and Elizabeth Warren are going to be standing right next to each other in the center. Maria, as you look ahead to this debate, these debates with all these candidates, what is the strategy? What is going to make somebody stand out? Because as we remember the last time with the Republicans, when there were so many candidates on the stage, the most outrageous thing was what got all the headlines, and it was almost always Trump.
Right. I think that's going to be the big difference between the Republican debates and the Democratic debates. I think what you're going to see in the Democratic debates are all of these candidates focused on the issues. We know that when we focus on issues, we win. It happened in 2018 when Trump doubled down on bigotry and racism prior to the 2018 elections. America rejected that and they elected Democrats to take over the House. This is what is wrong with what he is doing in terms of what his strategy is. So on the Democratic side, you're going to see candidates talk about health care, which we know Republicans want to take away, talk about women's reproductive rights, which we know Republicans want to go back to the 50s where women were dying. They're going to talk about a fair immigration policy that is not based on xenophobia and bigotry. And they're going to talk about how they're going to give the tools for Americans to live a better life. You're not going to hear talk about hand size or anything like that.
Yeah. Matt Mikowiak, yes, it will be earnest, perhaps, and it'll be, these news topics, no hand size, and maybe that will, be clear to people. But what are you anticipating?
Yeah, I'd say a couple things. From my standpoint, I think Elizabeth Warren has been done a disservice by getting, the first night with the only she's the only one of the top.
They're
five
calling
candidates.
It the junior varsity.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's a little bit demeaning, but it's obviously not her fault. Apparently, it was random. Who knows? But when you have four of the top five candidates, including Biden, on the second night, I think that the TV audience is going to be a lot smaller. Let's keep one thing in mind. I forget if these debates are 90 minutes or 2 hours, but with 10 candidates on the stage, you're going to have 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes at most for each person. That's actually a pretty low threshold. So I do think the question is, will these debates change this race in any way? Will someone break out? Will someone challenge Biden? How will he respond? Does someone make a huge mistake? From a sort of substantive and ideological standpoint, there's a lot of similarities among these candidates in terms of the ideas they're putting out there, the issues they're talking about. Biden's really the outlier. And so the question is he going to be able to demonstrate that he's the front runner? Is he he's going to be the front runner going in? Is he going to be the front runner coming out? I think that's the biggest question.
Hey, Matt, I just want to take a second, make sure we've asked you as a strategist about President Trump's remarks on the Central Park Five. He was asked about this yesterday. He's, of course, the one who called for the death penalty back in the, in the 80s for these five young men who were, it turned out, completely falsely accused of a brutal rape in Central Park. Somebody else came forward and claimed that attack. His DNA matched. Mm-hmm. There was never any evidence that linked these five young men. And he was asked to apologize for this. There's a Netflix series going on right now. Here's his response.
Why do you bring that question up now? It's an interesting time to bring it up. You have people on both sides of that. They admitted their guilt.
You have people on both sides of that, Matt. I mean, that is just an echo of what he said about the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. How would you have guided there?
Well, yeah, I doubt he's aware of the Netflix series. I doubt he's. He
doesn't
seem the kind
of person. Not aware of a major television series?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't think he's sitting around watching Netflix. I just don't think he's digitally connected that way.
But because he took out ads at the time calling for the death penalty. So he's been much discussed because of the series. But you don't think he's aware?
No, look,
if he's not aware, I think his staff did him a disservice.
Right.
Well, either way, I mean, look, I think he was unprepared for that question. It's why he asked, you know, why bring it up? If he knew there was a series, he would have connected that. Look, I mean, one of the things we know about President Trump is that he does not like to admit that he's wrong, even when he is wrong. And in this case, obviously, you know, he's wrong. There's not much debate about that. Oftentimes the press wants to make him apologize for different things, and that goes against his personality type. It's one of his, I think, character flaws, character weaknesses. We all have them. I wish he would, you know, apologize, admit what everyone recognizes and move on. It would be much better.
Maria, just a few seconds left here, but Nancy Pelosi now saying that if the goods are there, you must impeach. Do you think that the needle is moving on impeachment?
Well, I think that's the whole reason why she wants to push for all of the investigations that Democrats are involved in right now. And when you have today, Hope Hicks is testifying and she is answering hardly any questions because the Department of Justice is telling her not to answer any of these questions. I think the American people understand that there are clearly things that this administration wants to hide. And so if Democrats continue on this road, which is guided by Nancy Pelosi, on investigating and on doing their constitutional duty to hold this president accountable, yeah, there could be a time where we get to impeachment, and that's where we have to go.
Maria Cardona and Matt Mikowiak, thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
When Mohamed Morsi died this week in a courtroom in Egypt, it was noted with a moment of silence in a theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Let's back up. Morsi was the first democratically elected president of Egypt after the 2011 uprising that deposed longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak. Then Morsi himself was removed in a military coup because even though freely elected, he was a member of the Islamist group the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi was arrested, his group outlawed. Now he's died, and Egypt, which broke free of the dictator Mubarak, is now locked in a repressive military regime led by General al-Sisi.
I was one person who had an idea, who made it words, and someone heard, everybody. I was one person.
The new musical, We Live in Cairo, at the American Repertory Theater, tells how one person, then another, word of mouth, ignited the 2011 uprising that deposed Mubarak.
President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down as president of Egypt, and he has decided that the higher council of the armed forces will lead the nation.
The play blends real news footage, here the sounds of cheering protesters in Tahrir Square, with musical recreations, here that moment on stage. Meanwhile, the social media messages that spread the revolution are projected on parachute material as it unspools across the ceiling. The musical takes us there through six young activists, composites of real-life participants like the blogger Sand Monkey or Wael Ghanim, a marketing manager at Google who called this revolution 2.0. Two of the characters are brothers. We learn two brothers created this musical, so we assume they must have been there in Egypt as well. And I'm hearing you are from Boylston, Massachusetts?
That's right.
You had never been to Egypt prior to writing this?
When we started it, we hadn't.
That's Daniel and Patrick Lazur, who were students in 2011 when they saw a picture. Patrick, talk about the photograph that actually inspired all of this.
Yeah, sure. It's a photograph by Ed O from the New York Times. He took this really incredible photo about seven floors above the square of all of these students around a table there are two or three laptops. There's a camera. There's like a roll of toilet paper there. All of these different. It's so youthful and so dynamic, and they're all uploading testimonials and photos and videos and these things for the protests down seven floors below them. And so we saw this photo and we're like, wow, this is. I mean, there's a musicality to this, and there's a youthfulness to this, and that's I think what we were so drawn to when we started this show.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what really drew us to the story is these young people about our age. When we started, I was 19, Patrick was 22. Not only how young they were, but what was at stake for them. I mean, this was a 30-year dictatorship, and had they not succeeded in toppling Mubarak, they could have been jailed, tortured, or worse. Seeing them talk with such verve and such bravery about what change they wanted to see in their country, I think was really inspiring.
In this scene, the students give their reasons for revolution, starting with a slain protester.
For Khaled Said, whose beaten face, the disc of blood on the metal gurney, his jaw, the gash that showed his gums and his teeth, I will never forget until the day I die.
For my mother, who has protested the Mubarak regime her entire life. For my grandfather, who died in Tora prison for speaking out against Nasser.
For an honest system of government, for term limits, for free and fair elections, for a constitution that takes all Egyptians into account. Poor, rich, Muslim, Christian.
For my family, so that they can afford a meal at the end of every day, for their dignity.
For all of us to live how we choose to live, without fear and without shame. For love.
The first draft was very much about the hopefulness of 2011, and that's really where that initial draft ended, at the, you know, when Mubarak fell, and that was sort of our bookend for the show. But then, as you know, as the years started progressing, as history started unfolding, we had to include what was happening post-revolution.
Yeah, Mubarak falls, the Muslim Brotherhood rises up. Suddenly, the activists are divided between the secular and the military, who are against the Muslim Brotherhood, and those who are Muslim who are saying, wait a second, it's not an Islamist organization.
I've heard of a petition collecting signatures calling for Morsi to step down.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
I've heard about that, too, and I think it's very unwise.
Can you tell us why?
Because we just had the first free and fair election in our country in 30 years. So what, we start some petition to throw Morsi out and undo all the work we've done up to now? What would that say?
That Egyptians will not stand for a country run by the Brotherhood.
It says we can knock down, but we can't build up.
Habibi, you're a Christian. Do you understand what Sharia will do to you?
Morsi will not enact Sharia. He said that. You heard him.
Man is an Islamist.
Yeah, but to throw him out of office after less than a year, it's reactionary.
Where is this coming from?
I don't know. A rational brain.
You suddenly have what, Patrick, on your hands? I mean, it is not a happy ending.
Yeah, it's a titanic sort of moment in history. If we wanted to tell the story of the revolution, I think it needed to be honored.
Speak. I've been here waiting for you.
Talk about the music. Your grandfather is Lebanese. And I'm thinking, too, because I read somewhere that you grew up listening to the music of the region, Khatoum. And, you know, we've spoken with David Yazbek, who wrote the music for the band's visit.
Fellow Lebanese, yeah.
Right. And also heard Khatoum, the great singer, on a radio somewhere. And he wrote that beautiful song, Khatoum and Omar Sharif.
Yeah.
For the band's visit. Were you conscious of that?
In terms of us being sort of in community with a fellow Arab American musical theater writer is so exciting. And I think it's due time that these rhythms and these modes start making their way to the stage, trying to not make it this exotic thing to have the oud playing or the dumbek, this hand drum. I mean, it's such an infectious sound.
I want to chant things.
I want to sing things.
I want to bring things back to attack.
Patrick, you did go and workshop it at the American University in Cairo, I think. Were you nervous that some of the people who had actually risked their lives might have been upset that you were telling their story?
Yeah, actually, our mom's side of the family is Lebanese, and our dad's is Irish and Albanian. So yes, we are Arab Americans, but we are not Egyptian. And going in to a group of young people who were part of the revolution and revolutionaries, wow, you know, this is going to be an uphill battle. I mean, we are the outsiders coming in and telling this story. We did a private reading at the university as a result of censorship. You know, I think there was a little bit of arm's length at the beginning, but what was incredible is after the show happened, there were critiques. There were so many thoughts and so many things that, oh, that's not right, that you need to, you know, improve upon, all this stuff, rightfully so. And but there was also such an enthusiasm, too, with the students that, you know, this story is being told. In Sisi's regime now, I mean, the revolution is scrubbed from the narrative, that you can't talk about the revolution. So we really were heartened by that. I think there was an incredible amount of excitement that this is something that is being forgotten and it is being told again. These true heroes of a modern time. So,
did you meet Sand Monkey or did you meet any of the people that you kind of have put into these composite characters?
We did speak with Wael Gonim, and you know, he was so helpful. And I think he really is sort of the heart of the revolution in a way. I mean, us watching those CNN interviews, and you just, you know, cry in tears as he's talking about what it means to him. And I think that also spurred us on to not just make it sort of docu-theater. There were real things at stake for these characters.
I can't forgive these people photos. I still remember them. This could have been me or my brother. And they were killed. They were killed as if they, if these people died in a war, that's fair and square. You know, you hold the weapon and, you know, someone is shooting, you know, and you died, but no.
Wael Gonim on CNN in 2011, an inspiration for Daniel and Patrick Lazur, whose musical We Live in Cairo on the Egyptian uprising and its aftermath is drawing the attention of reporters like NPR's Leila Falden, who recently did a talkback after the show, and also drawing the attention of activists who were there.
What's incredible about this moment is that we are in the company of so, so many revolutionaries. I mean, Ganzir, who was a huge street artist, actually exiled from Egypt, he did our poster art for the show. There are people who are coming, there are Egyptians who are coming to this show and saying, you know, this is something you speak to the emotions of the time and to the, as actually Leila said this, the roller coaster of emotions that was going on during the revolution and afterwards. And
Leila Fadel just said that she cried through the whole program. I wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, I would just say that is the ultimate kind of that is the thing that moves us the most and moves us to continue with this show, because it's the people who understand what happened, people saying, you know, you got it right. That's like, it's the thing that keeps this thing all worth it.
I was one person who had an idea, who made it words, and someone heard.
The brothers Daniel and Patrick Lazur, whose musical We Live in Cairo is having its world premiere at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tomorrow, NPR's Leila Falden, who covered the uprising and its aftermath in Egypt.
We had to run through an alleyway, which was the only exit out of the sit-in, that had gotten much more dangerous than when we ran in, because there were so many bullets being fired into the alley. It was being called Sniper Alley.
Leila's thoughts on that time and this musical tomorrow.
Come anyway, go to the square, go to the square, you'll know the words when you are there.
Even though the unemployment rate has been coming down to multi-decade lows, it is higher for African Americans than it is for whites. Which brings us to Columbus, Ohio, where a hairstylist is teaching young black kids how to turn hair into a career. Queen Roche has a bus that she takes to community centers around the city with the aim of passing on her skills and helping young women get their natural hair licenses. Adora Numigaide from member station WOSU reports.
Queen Roche ushers a group of girls onto her bus. School's out, and the kids have come to the Central Community House while they wait for their parents to get off work.
We are doing an outreach program, if you will. So we're going out to the community centers, our second chance high schools, with job corps, anything of that nature.
Roche runs Naps, Kinks, and BB's Natural Hair Salon. Styling hair wasn't her plan as a kid, but she's glad that's how she makes her living.
I love it. It's fun for me, and I figured out how to monetize it and cultivate a business for myself. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It wasn't hard to do, but I did not know that I was in business, certainly not at 14, 15, 16 on a porch.
Roche wanted to teach others to do the same. So she bought an old bus for $1,000 and converted it into a mobile salon. 10-year-old Zayara Evans comes to the Central Community House every day after school. She loves to do her own hair. Now, she wants to learn how to style other people's.
I just now need to learn how to, like, start the braids off and how to, like, knot it when I'm finished and all type of different things.
Evans is among the group of elementary and middle school girls whom Roche will teach to do hair a couple of times a week this spring and summer. So far, 20 people have gotten their natural hair license through her. Students like Peyton Williams. She's volunteering for the Hair Matters bus.
Actually being able to get in there and see the way the business is ran, the way that the money flows, see the way that the service is supposed to be, all the things that you need to basically produce a good business, to brand yourself.
Williams is 19. She's been able to take her license for freelance hair gigs around the state. She wants to join Roche in empowering other young women to do the same.
Roche can't get rid of me. I love hair also. I love the braid hair. I just love all types of hair. And plus also bringing younger girls on board, because growing up, they just be like, oh, you know, I want to do hair, but they don't know the steps that you have to take.
Roche is expanding the natural hair license opportunity to others who may not be able to afford it. The process can cost around $1,000.
So we created a scholarship initiative. So for every shampoo assistant tuition pay, which is about $1,200, that's their kit and everything inclusive, t-shirts, all of that, and field trips, we will scholarship in a child in need.
Roche says she wants to focus on kids who are aging out of the foster care system and need a skill set. A Columbus Foundation grant funds the effort with Central Community House. Arts programmer Katarina Harris says the program will help Black kids form connections with professionals who look like them.
Because all of the children in our middle school program are Black, and making sure that they have Black outlets and see professional Black folks do their jobs.
It's a job that's supported Roche and her family for years. She wants to pass on the skill, both for its creative and money-generating value.
I was that little girl just doing hair. And I found my way in it. I've raised 6 children in it.
Roche says she will partner with the Urban League in the future and hopes to take her bus to other area programs and community events, eventually crossing state lines. For Here and Now, I'm Adora Namigadde in Columbus, Ohio.
And now we want to take up the College Board's plan to expand the rollout of the overall disadvantage level. That's a numerical rating system to figure out what's impacting students. It could be medium family income, percentage of a home on food stamps, percentage of adults with agricultural jobs, and consider the so-called adversity index in judging SATs. Well, the plan's getting mixed reactions, but our next guest says it might help kids like the one he once was, in rural areas. 59% of rural high school grads go to college, fewer than urban and suburban kids. They're also much more likely to drop out, and only 29% of rural residents, 18 to 24, are in college, compared to 47% in the rest of the country. Tony Rehagen explored all this for the Boston Globe. He joins us from St. Peter's, Missouri, where he lives. And Tony, you point out this gap in admissions and say this could help rural kids.
Yeah, that's the hope anyway. It's something that's interesting. I come from an extremely rural background. I come from a town in central Missouri of about 300 people. My graduating class was 28. And I just remember my experience kind of being bewildered. I went to Mizzou, which is our big state university here. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of dawned on me how it kind of shaped my life. I grew up quite conservative. And just as happenstance, you know, I went to a big college for the first time. I was around people that were different than me politically, ethnically, racially, and religiously. And it really opened my eyes to things. And it did change me. My views are much more left now, but it's not even that. It's more about the fact that I was forced to kind of defend and challenge my own beliefs and opinions in the face of differences. And I think that's something that we don't really have as much of nowadays. I think that's what's really lacking in our political discourse, is that empathy.
Yeah. Well, so you've said a lot here. So let's take a deeper look. First of all, you go to the University of Missouri, 1997, like 20% of everybody else in America. You came from this small town, very conservative family. You'd sit and, as you write, grumble along with your father as you listen to Rush Limbaugh and read George F. Will. Nothing wrong with that. Most of the people in your family had not even gone to high school. They were needed in farms. you realize that, you know, nothing wrong with farming, but you wouldn't have been very good at it. You know,
that would have been awful at it. Awful at it.
You know, these weren't your skills. So off you go to college. And as you say, like, you're confronted with things you never heard or saw in your very small town. What were some of those things?
I mean, just something as simple. I lived in a co-ed dorm where, every other floor was boy, girl, boy, girl. So for the first time, I'm living around, you know, women in close proximity. People at my next door dorm mate was from Istanbul. At my first time around, really around a large population of African-American students. You know, you'd start meeting them. I went to a black fraternity party. You know, I go to the local mosque. And this was back in the 1990s. So kind of the pride movement was going on. You get kind of swept up in that. And you really kind of get to see it firsthand. And you realize that these opinions that you've had and these political views you've had that were based solely on what you've read from the outside world, because what you see in front of you is very homogenous and very unquestioning. You get to see the people behind these statistics and these political positions, and you get to really—it's about empathy, and it's something that's—it seems simple, but I think it's lacking nowadays.
Well, this is another thing you note, that there's been a right-wing anti-intellectualism movement that many rural Americans are buying into, and it's being told to them that universities are hatcheries for liberalism, socialism, any other ism. Is this something you heard?
No, but I did hear from people, because I had other friends who did go to college from my small town who did not, and my parents went to college, and they did not, they did not convert to liberalism. And, you know, they kind of teased me and razzed me about, you know, being indoctrinated by that. And it is. I mean, it's a lot of this, especially the things we're talking about nowadays, you know, immigration, terrorism. It plays on xenophobia. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. It's just that fear of the other. And when you don't live around the other, that fear is so easy to nurture and to play off of and to really take advantage of, which I think is a shame.
Well, so you talk about this sort of anti-intellectualism movement. Which is very sad, by the way. I mean, do you find that sad?
Yeah, I do. I find it sad that people are turning their back on science and fact in general. And I don't think, I don't think that's a strictly conservative thing, but they seem to have institutionalized it and are really kind of playing on it. But I mean, when you're talking about climate change, which may be the biggest threat that any of us are facing right now, you know, they're able to kind of turn their backs on scientific fact and the agreement of all these scientists, people that are experts in this. And it's, anti-expertism. I mean, I'm not sure if that's even the right word, but this idea that, you know, they know better just because, and that's not just conservative. That's a lot of people who just have a kind of disdain for people, for intellectuals, and for people who are experts in their field, especially when it comes to science. And again, it plays on the idea that if you don't understand it, it's something to be feared, like physics, which is terrifying. If you don't know anything about it, but that's why you make yourself trust the physicist.
Right. Well, and by the way, you say that schools are playing into this narrative somewhat by banning speech that they consider extreme, that you say this students are expected to use this highly edited and careful language, and you think that there's some danger there as well. You know, people on the liberal side of the equation might not be hearing viewpoints that they should be hearing. But I want to put that aside for a second, because so you talk about the gap between those who go to college and those don't in terms of economics, but also in terms of politics, as we just heard, you know, that this has to do with the political divide in the country. But
right.
You also point out that people in rural areas are not sought after by colleges. Your class of 26 was not going to get any recruiters. You say schools are ignoring them, which another reason why this adversity rating might help make up for that gap.
That's the biggest thing, and at the center of this story, is the idea that it won't allow college recruiters who have so much power now to kind of dictate the diversity of campus makeup to overlook the rural areas. And look, I mean, all this comes down to economics in the end. Like, it's the economics of sending a recruiter out, you know, 2 hours, I mean, in Michigan, from University of Michigan up to the Upper Peninsula, where there's a lot of rural students. I mean, that could be a multiple-hour drive. That's a huge journey to try to, you know, recruit kids from classes as small as mine. But the idea of this index might give the
recruiters another kind of insight into these students, not to play into the stereotypes of a rural student, to say that they don't have a college background, that they don't have an interest in it, and that, you know, that they're just farm kids who don't have anything to offer the colleges. My hope is that this adversity index, even if it can't do that on its own, is a sign that recruiters and college institutions are going to start looking a little deeper to kind of get that element onto campus.
Well, and it's not just that they don't go to the schools. A quarter of people in rural areas don't have high-speed broadband, so they're not finding things online.
Right, and that's something people don't realize.
This might overcome some of that. And again, why would it make a difference for you? You're not talking about – well, maybe you are. I don't know. Are you talking about maybe converting some people would be the word that some would use, trying to get more eyes opened about, you know, what you've now seen? Or –
No, I don't think it's about conversion at all, because I think, like I said, some people that are very important to me, that who are some of the most intelligent people I know, went to college and did not have their political, you know, worlds turned over. That's just my personal experience. Again, I don't think you know what you think and know your opinion until you're forced to defend that opinion. And that's kind of what college is about to me. College is not about the curriculum, not about the tests, the lectures and stuff. It's about kind of living and working and being forced to defend your own opinions. Like, it's easy to talk about, you know, Islamic terrorism and Muslims when you're hours away from the nearest one or you've never met one. But if you're living with one, if you're friends with one, if you're, you know, that puts a different perspective. And it's the same with the intellectualism. If you don't know, if you don't have a nuclear physicist in your small town, you go to college and you learn about these things. You kind of see the expertise. And by the way, also it works the other way. If there isn't a small town rural representation on the campus, then all these liberal students who come from the suburbs and from urban areas don't get that exposure in return. So it works both ways.
Well, you've put a lot of hope into this one calculation, this adversity rating, yeah.
Yeah, well, and as I said, I'm not even sure it is a cure-all, and my hope is that it's a sign that people are looking into the problem and wanting to address it, that it's getting attention.
That's Tony Rehagen, a writer based in Missouri. Tony, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Some of the country's top pilots are on Capitol Hill today to express concerns about Boeing.
These two recent crashes happened in foreign countries. But if we do not address all the important issues and factors, they can and will happen here.
That's Captain Sully Sullenberger, who became famous in 2009 for successfully landing a U.S. Airways flight in the Hudson River. He's been critical of Boeing for not offering proper training to pilots, especially with the 737 MAX. That said, Boeing had a very good week at the Paris Air Show, where the company just inked a huge deal with British Airways owner AIG, which will buy 200 of the 737 MAX planes that have been grounded for months. For more, let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this deal is being estimated at around $24 billion. How big of a coup is this for Boeing, which has been having all these problems after the two crashes of the 737 MAX?
I'd say this is more a sense of relief than a cause for celebration here. Yeah, they needed to get this behind them, a whole series of milestones, right? Want to get the plane up and flying, then carrying passengers. You wanted to get your first order after everything. They've now done that. As you said, $24 billion. That's at list prices, by the way. These manufacturers and airlines never disclose exactly what an airline is paying for something. I can promise you IAG got a very good deal on these planes.
So is that Boeing's way forward for the moment, is to just give big discounts to companies that want to buy the 737 MAX?
Clearly. They would have hoped at this point in the program to not have to be doing that anymore. That's very typical early in an aircraft program when a manufacturer like Boeing or Airbus is trying to get traction for a new kind of aircraft, offer big discounts, get your first big orders. By now, with thousands of MAXs on order, they would have hoped to be charging much closer to list prices. Yeah, sure, giving some discounts for very good customers and so forth. But now they're back in this spot where where they were desperate for an order, and you have a big airline that is a good customer willing to order a lot of them. I'm sure that all came together into a very good deal for IAG. And aircraft pricing is extraordinarily important for airlines because, I mean, the airplanes are the most expensive things they buy. So as an airline, if you can pay a lot less than your competitor for the most expensive thing you buy, that can give you a lasting competitive advantage.
So what are some of the safety concerns that are still outstanding for the 737 MAX before it can be cleared to fly again?
Well, you've got that MCAS anti-stall system that was supposed to prevent crashes, instead blamed for perhaps causing two of them, at least partly. And people out there, including the union representing American Airlines pilots, saying that they're concerned that the new training is perhaps not adequate. That was part of the issue here. The plane was doing things that pilots, to varying degrees, rather, didn't clearly exactly understand what the new systems were designed to do and what they were doing. And so that's one of the concerns. That's a big deal because, the point of this plane, it was sort of a line Boeing was walking, a two-pronged approach, saying on one hand, you're going to get revolutionary economics, a new plane in all the right ways, but at the same time, a plane that you could just sort of drop into your fleet and the same pilots could fly it, the same mechanics could work on it. The problem was that there seemed to be more differences than they were saying, and the question here is just how much training do pilots need to fly the new plane? And the more they need, the more expensive that also is for airlines and the less attractive, perhaps, the MAX is to airlines. And so these are all extraordinarily important considerations, all of it. Obviously, safety is the very most important consideration of all.
So when is it likely to be back in the air?
Test flights any day now. Carrying passengers, probably not before about September, based on just kind of watching what airlines are doing with their schedules. American and Southwest Airlines, for example, have taken the MAX out of their schedules until early September. And I would say that's not a deadline. That's an at least, because airlines don't want to take an airplane out and then put it back in. That would be complicated once they've already canceled flights. So at least September in the U.S., probably longer in other parts of the world. The FAA's counterparts around the world sort of feel this pressure to do their own scrutiny here after what happened with this credibility crisis that Boeing and the FAA kind of have accusations of not having done enough in the first place.
Okay, one more thing I have to ask you about, Seth, which is that you're joining us from Atlanta today because your four-year-old daughter is attending rail camp. I guess like father, like daughter in this case.
Yeah.
Loves transportation. Tell me, what is that?
Aubriana was, she's crazy about trains, and she wanted to go to a train camp. And it's actually rather hard to find one that takes four-year-olds. I mean, lots of kids are crazy about trains. The camps are everywhere. But in terms of a kid her age, yeah, I found one at what's called the Southeastern Railway Museum down here. So we took Amtrak down. She loved it. And that's what she's doing here. And all indications are that, yeah, she's every bit as enthusiastic about trains as she was going into it.
That is awesome. Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst with Here and Now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Isn't that great?
I want to go to rail camp.
It sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.